This is Wade's World, where we talk to the most interesting people in the world on KABF 88.3, the voice of the people.
You want to see how the other half lives?
This is Wade Rathke, and you're listening to Wade's World. It's Friday morning, 9 to 9:30 Central Standard Time in the United States, and your time for the voice of the people. Welcome to the east side of town so that we can talk about how the other half lives and what life is like here living in Wade's World, whether that's the east side of Little Rock, where KABF 88.3 is located, or the east side of New Orleans, where WAMF 90.3 is housed, or Greenville, Nairobi, Bengaluru, Bristol, or Bombay, points east and west, where we are either rebroadcast or live streamed at www.kabf.org. Podcasts will be available to this show on Monday at that website. You know the story on Wade's World. We talk to the most interesting people in the world. And today, we're talking to Professor Corey Dolgan, Stonehill College. We had him on some months ago talking about his book, Kill It or Save It, and he's got a new postscript. Reached out for me and said, hey, let me be honest, I want to tell people I told you so. Corey, welcome back to Wade's World.
Thank you so much, Wade.
Glad to have you. So, remind people who may not have caught the first show what Kill It or Save It was about, and then let's get right into how you told the show.
Sounds great. So Kill It or Save It comes out of the Vietnam War and the notion that it was necessary to kill the village, burn the village to save the country. And my thinking about contemporary American politics and policy is that we've adopted, in essence, the same strategy, which is to kill the public sector to save the public sector, to kill our national institutions, our national treasures, in order to supposedly save them. And the book is really about contemporary institutions like education, healthcare, governing, and economics and our economy as a whole. And how our contemporary kind of neoliberal, privatized, hyper-individualistic policymaking has really destroyed what was creating during most of the 20th century a public welfare state that built our middle class.
Absolutely. And we're certainly seeing a strong commitment from the current administration to kill almost everything that the Obama administration tried to do, it seems. I don't know, to save what, make America great, save something from something. But you go through a long list of those kinds of items in a new postscript you wrote for the book, right?
Well, that's right. And I want to be fair in my consternation for the Democrats as well as the Republicans. Much of the book is written with the assumption that Hillary Clinton was going to win. And the argument in the book is that neoliberalism and neoconservatism have come together. And so the Democrats, I think, have been in many ways just as responsible as the Republicans for promoting privatization, for promoting a kind of an educational system based on charter schools and choice, which has really devastated public schools around the country. New Orleans is an example, I think. So I want to make sure that we give everybody their due. But,
this is an equal opportunity criticism.
That's right. Now, I do think that the idea that Donald Trump is now our president is the crystallization of this Kill It to Save It policymaking, where in the postscript I look at things like cabinet appointments and agency appointments, and we look at Donald Trump bringing in people who themselves believe in destroying those very agencies they're now heading. I think Ben Carson at HUD and Rick Perry at Energy, Betsy DeVos at Education, these are all people who have been on record as wanting to make sure these agencies were terminated. And now they're the heads of them. But nowhere is that more true than at the EPA and what we're now hearing about Scott Pruitt.
What is it about these Kill It and Save It folks that they can't stop from padding their own lair? We've had Ben Carson and his $31,000 office remodel. Now we've got Scott Pruitt of EPA, $70,000 for two desks. I mean, I hope they have wheels and can drive him home. I mean, wow. I mean, and then they all like to fly first class. I mean, he wants a 25-person security team, a bubble to have secret conversations so none of his workers – I mean, but he's not the only one. The Veterans Administration, I mean, it just goes on and on. What's it with this?
Yeah,
they
right.
think they don't like the agency, but they sure want to line their pockets, it seems.
Well, you know, anybody who preaches, and I use that word, purposely, anyone who preaches this kind of basic morality, in this case around economics, around capitalism, the idea that the private sector knows what's best for people, that they run more efficiently, that it's all about hard work and Protestant work ethic. You know, they're usually the first ones to expose themselves as these kind of arrogant, pathological, greedy corporate fat cats. And, whether they were in the corporate sector or they're in the corporate sector's pockets, it's not all that much different from the really hardcore fundamentalist preachers who turn out to be, stepping out on their wives and looking at, child pornography.
It's ironic, though, that they can argue that the, mainstream media, is out to get them and then not cover their own butts. I mean, what kind of... What kind of arrogance is that?
They do their best to cover their butts, but their butts are pretty big to cover. I mean, their arrogance and their greed end up, getting them in trouble, because they can't hold it in, literally and figuratively.
So we're seeing a similar phenomena that's kind of amazing that the Consumer Finance Protection Bureau that clearly has never been the favorite of Wall Street, and certainly the fat cats there and many of the donors have wanted it gone. But that's a perfect example of your argument about, they moved the Mick Mulvaney from the Office of Management Budget. He gets two jobs now and one paycheck. He is now heading CFPB, asked for zero appropriations, and seems intent on killing the agency, wouldn't you say? Or can he do?
Oh, absolutely. Well, I mean, as I document in the postscript, the appointments for these agencies and for the cabinet, in some ways, are almost moot points given the budget, and essentially the Trump administration has cut the budgets of so many agencies to the bone, that even if they had people at the helm who cared about these issues, they wouldn't be able to do much. Nowhere is that more clear than in the State Department, where, foreign policy is not only being driven by the whim of Donald Trump, but there actually aren't enough people in the field to give him the information he would need to think otherwise. But I think the consumer protection agency is another point. And, yeah, they're going to zero out everything they can. Right now I'm on a Fulbright award, and they're looking to cut the Fulbright award commission by 90%. So I think you'll find that anything that reeks of a kind of global commitment, that reeks of a kind of public sector commitment, is finding their budgets cut severely.
It's almost deeper than that when you mentioned the Fulbright point. I saw a survey recently, I forget whether it was Pew or whatever, that 59% of Republicans or those leaning Republican are not sure that college is a good idea because of the kind of ideas it fosters. Wow. Fulbright, that's like collateral damage. It lets you understand why public and private institutions that receive government money, because, Harvard gets, half $1 billion, they're going to be cut on this rampage too, aren't they?
No, that's right. And I'm very critical of education and higher education in the book for a variety of reasons, and I think the major one is that we've watched neoliberalism and privatization, corporatization kind of destroy so much of what public education and higher education was about. We can't just be turning out, marketable units in higher education. It was really, intended to not only foster critical thinking and a critical perspective on the world, but also, whether it's philosophical or engineering or scientific innovation, higher education has been at the forefront of promoting new ways of thinking about the world. And to think that Republicans are so afraid of ideas that they would, in fact, try to destroy these institutions and try to convince people that actually higher education is not in their best interest. This gets at what I think a lot of people now are talking about, which is a kind of creeping fascism. The idea that we're going to be anti-intellectual as well as anti-democratic seems to me part of what fascism has always been about.
It's a very scary time. We're talking to Corey Dolgan, who's a professor of sociology and is with Stonehill College in Massachusetts. He wrote a book called Kill It or Save It, and now there's a new postscript in which he gets to tell us so. Corey, about education, I think I noticed that you're in charge of the community learning program at Stonehill. Is that correct?
I stepped down from that position, but that's a position that I founded back in 2009 and just left in 2017.
Doesn't that address directly the point you were making about education now?
Well, I think we try to. I think that civic engagement has been a kind of counter trend in higher education, trying to really look at how students can learn by not only integrating and embracing the communities around the institutions, universities, and colleges, but also how they can take their classroom knowledge and apply it in the real world. And so I think that civic engagement in higher education has been this really interesting tension, tension with the corporatization movement. And I think you'll find that civic engagement around the country is in their own period of conflict because so many people want to engage and address the community, but colleges can't see the community as anything other than another commodity.
Well, that's discouraging. I was thinking maybe you had a good direction. You saw things going
you should
in
know
because,
better.
Yeah, I should. But the eternal optimism keeps me coming to work every day. Somehow, I believe we can get out of this muck and mire. But that's a different story. You're the one we're talking to today, not me. But
because
aren't more colleges and universities trying to do community learning? I mean, will that impact politically how people see higher education?
Well, one hopes so. One hopes so. But here's the thing. I would say that, we have to, in higher ed, we have to stop marketing what we do as solely for the marketplace. And so, we need to survive by getting more students to pay more tuition because we've cut so much funding to public institutions and colleges and universities. And so the more we try to enter the marketplace to survive, the more we focus on the marketplace. And so much of higher ed has become that. It's kind of ironic that at the same time that those of us who believe in progressive thinking and progressive action and thought that higher ed could be a place where we really train people to be citizens, that as we are losing that battle to neoliberalism, the Republicans and the right wing are actually trying to convince us that not even to go to college. So, it's kind of like you've already won this battle. Why are you rubbing it in? But I think you're rubbing it in, they're going to rub it too much, I mean, sometimes you overplay your hand. And I think that the majority of people in this country still believe that education is the key to democracy, that education is the key to social mobility, and certainly education is the key to social justice. So if you want some hope, I will give you hope that the students I see day in and day out still have a flicker. And what we're seeing around us now, I think the Parkland gun stuff is some of the most encouraging things we've seen in a long time from young people. And I think that young people don't want to be cannon fodder anymore. You know, they don't want to be the ones that we send off to slaughter every day in our schools and our streets. And I think that's where the hope lies right now in the real activism among young people in this country.
And, you know, I guess I could be the negative voice here. As long as we can con people that going to higher education will get them a job, which who knows if that's true. Corey.
Well,
I hear you. I mean, robot world is coming for us. Not my job is safe, but other than that, I'm not sure who else is. Corey, what do you make of the fact that Secretary DeVos and the Education Department asked for a, I think, $7 billion cut in her budget, and Congress in the recent proposal gave her a $2.5 billion increase in budget, including tying her hands around shutting down regional civil rights offices and a number of other programs. Is there hope somewhere that there's a way to staunch this kill it or save it kind of movement?
Well, I think there's a lot of hope, but I don't necessarily see that hope coming from above. I see yesterday someone at the conference I'm at suggested that Donald Trump certainly represented the most corporate right wing of the Republican Party, but that even they might have buyer's remorse at this point. And so, you know, it may be that even the Republicans recognize that they can't simply destroy public education in this country. And some of them still hearken back to a Republican ideology that suggested, you know, the most conservative people are the ones who believe that they have something to protect. And so public education has always been a, you know, a national treasure in the sense that people thought they should protect it and defend it. And even Republicans today are finding their limitations to destroying it.
And certainly what we're seeing from teachers themselves and the activity in West Virginia and now Oklahoma and North Carolina, and it looks like maybe Arizona. This is a direct assault on charterization, de-skilling and deprofessionalizing education and defunding it, isn't it?
That's absolutely right. And I think, you know, the teachers' unions for a long time have gotten a bad rap. And again, like many unions, they haven't always been at their best. But, you know, teachers now, with or without unions, and many of these movements are being led in right-to-work states and states where public unions don't exist or aren't very strong. But
well, at least they don't have collective agreements in most cases. I mean, the unions exist, but they don't have the kind of guarantees you would enjoy in Massachusetts or California or New York.
No, that's absolutely
your point still.
So what's happening? Well, I was just going to say, what's happening with these movements, and whether it's, you know, the kids in schools or it's the teachers in schools, these movements are coming together not only around education, but also around, as you suggested, you know, the work itself and the right to work. And I think that the right to organize, rather. And I think that people are recognizing that they can't count on their political leaders to work in their best interest. And it's not about bringing in even further and further to the right leaders, which I think Trump and the last decade has brought us. It's about empowering people themselves. And when the Democrats learn that that's what it's about, that's when the Democrats will really be stronger. And if the Democrats don't do it, then I think we're going to see more and more efforts at independent and alternative party movements that will empower the people in ways that matter.
Corey, as you've gone around with your book, what are you hearing in terms of reaction on this notion of protecting institutions and grassroots movements? Are you finding any encouraging signs out there as you put your finger in the wind?
Yeah, it's a great question, and the answer is an absolute yes. And so if I can kind of you know, flip the script a little bit and be a harbinger of good news for a change.
Here comes good news, fans. Okay,
that's right,
go.
That's right. Spoiler alert.
Yeah.
You know, one of the great things, I've been in over 25 different independent bookstores and a dozen or so campuses talking about the book. And it is true that after talking about the book and what is relatively, a dark analysis of what's happened, people want to know what can we do. And one of the things that's clear everywhere I've been is that, you know, people want someone to tell them what to do, but they're also already out there doing it. And so I'd say, at least a dozen different cities around the country are demonstrating really active local movements. There's the group Indivisible, which seems to have chapters now all over the country. There are obviously these national movements starting among teachers and students around gun policy. But, you know, I've seen people who come out to talk about the book, and they're talking about how many people they've gotten to run for office on local elections. People are interested in politics again. And whether it's been the women's marches or the anti-travel ban activism, the folks who have come out in city after city to just decimate the neo-Nazi movement and the alt-right movement, we're seeing people start to galvanize, which I think gets back to the purpose of the book. The real purpose of the book was not simply to give a dark analysis, but it was to suggest that as we organize and galvanize and start to mobilize, we need to have an analysis that suggests it's not just about electing Democrats in 2018. Because if these Democrats are the same as the Democrats have been for the last decade or two, then this isn't the change we're looking for. You know, Obama was not the change we were looking for, and I think that was unfortunate. It was better than Trump, but I think if our choices continue to be conservative Democrats or really conservative Republicans, then a real progressive return to a kind of social welfare state that gave us the middle class, that empowered the working class. We need really progressive candidates, and if they can come from the Democratic Party, so be it. But if they can't, we're going to have to demand something different.
I got a lot of positive reaction when I was talking to people in our offices in the UK and France recently, when they would ask about, well, what does it mean, what's Bernie Sanders doing these days and this, that, and the other? And I'd say, well, you have to understand, we have a two-party situation in the U.S. We have a far-right party and we have a center-right party. And so there's plenty of room. Now, why Senator Sanders is focusing on the center-right party instead of going another direction, I can't answer. But we're talking to Corey Dolgan, who's a professor at Stonehill College, and his book, Kill It or Save It, he's got a new postscript as it comes out in a new edition. In the postscript, you point out three conditions in a democracy movement: dispersion of power, transparency, and a commitment to mutual accountability. How do you see that working, Corey?
Well, I think the dispersion of power is certainly key, and I think that that's really what we're seeing as people are organizing and mobilizing around the country. And so very, very excited about what these movements represent. And certainly, you know, the old adage of power to the people, of democracy in the streets, you know, these are the things that that I think we're seeing not just, you know, a spattering of anymore, but we're really seeing, kind of in-depth and large movements all around the country. When we talk about, some of the other aspects of what we would hope to see in this democracy movement, I do think that the need for transparency is powerful, and so powerful that I think we're watching one of the key aspects of Trumpism be this attempt to minimize what we can think about critically. So the whole fake news movement, I think, is fascinating, and it's a sign of the power that we can have from critical thinking based on you know, our ability to discern what the facts are. And I have to kind of an aside, but related to this, a quick story. We had an orientation in the Fulbright program where we had someone from the State Department in Austria give us a talk about what the State Department's interests are these days, and specifically in Austria. And I expected to disagree with the State Department and their analysis of situations around the world, and I wasn't expecting much different. But I wasn't expecting this official to tell us a story about fake news and to tell us that we shouldn't believe what we read in the press anymore. And I thought, oh, my goodness, the State Department really has these talking points now from the Trump administration to try to delegitimize critical thinking. And here we were, you know, a dozen or so scholars being told by an official not to kind of believe what we see and what we read. So, you know, the transparency is so necessary for us to be a democratic citizenship. But people are demanding it. People are demanding it, and I have great hope that whether it's, you know, great radio stations like yours or alternative press around the country, the word is getting out, the truth is getting out, and people are getting mobilized.
And certainly you saw the thing about Sinclair News, Sinclair Broadcast, which owns, 200 stations around the country, a forced read by that sort of said, believe us, and the rest of the media, those big people, they don't, they're nothing but fake news. So it goes on and on. It's a difficult time, and people are certainly trying to respond to it. And are you finding the same kind of energy in the classroom there at Stonehill?
I'm seeing the beginning of that kind of energy. We've created, as I suggested in the book, a student population that's very stressed and very worried and nervous about their future. And so we constantly are trying to sell them on college's ability to give them a foot up for a job. But again, I think we're finding that the whole notion of jobs as a solution to people's survival is going to be called into question as automation continues. And so what I do really appreciate in our students is that they're trying to think about alternative ways of doing things. And I believe that in their search for something alternative, they're also going to come up with an alternative way to think about how we organize our society for the betterment of people, not just for the betterment of corporations. If corporations can't offer the jobs that people need to survive, then the corporations have kind of run their race too. And that means that at a certain point, we either will have fascism, which means that corporatism will take over and they'll manage the rest of us for the betterment of their own survival, or the people will demand a new way to organize society. And I think that's where the glimmer of hope is people's not only organizing and mobilizing, but willingness to think differently about what kind of society we want.
Fortunately, those people who believe we can organize that new society with social media are getting a little bit of a wake-up call here with the troubles and you talk about transparency, accountability, and things like this, dispersion of power. None of that has to do with social media and Facebook, does it, Corey?
No, it doesn't. People have often looked for technocratic solutions to issues of justice, and they're always found wanting. It's not the new technology. It's the organization of that technology and the humanizing of the goals of that technology, and we're that's going to be part of this movement as well.
Corey, where can tell people where they can get your book and how they can get in touch with you if they want to continue this conversation or find more information from you about Kill It or Save It?
Sure. People can always get books online. I prefer to encourage them to go to local bookstores. I just did a book signing here at the conference. We'll have a bunch of books at Octavia Books in New Orleans. And most of the local bookstores and independent bookstores these days have an online presence, so you can order them online through them. And people can always get in touch with me at cdalton at stonehill.edu, and I'm happy to talk to them about this or the next book I'm writing, which is called American Fascism. And hopefully we'll be able to get together when that comes out.
Well, I think we're already hearing some of the research and some of the early paragraphs from it. Thank you for being with me again, Corey. This has been Wade's World for another week. The World Where the Other Half Lives, where we talk about things you've never heard, and as Lucinda Williams sang, things you've never seen and will never forget. As the song goes, we say it loud, we say it on the air, we say it on the radio, until next week when we have Melody Lopez talking to us about civic engagement and the table she runs in New York State to make it happen. She'll be our guest on Wade's World. This is Wade Rathke from Wade's World. Thank you again. We'll see you next week.
This program is produced by the Arkansas Broadcasting Foundation, KABF-FM in Little Rock, Arkansas, and is distributed through Affiliated Media Foundation Movement, AMFM, serving the needs and interests of low and moderate income Americans.